You're listening to Economics Amplified, the latest thinking on the biggest issues from UChicago's Becker-Friedman Institute.
Thank you all for coming to this unique opportunity to interview Richard Thaler. We've been chasing him for a Becker Brown Bag since we did our first Becker Brown Bag, probably 7 years ago, and I don't know how we managed to trick him into being here today, but
you promised me a free lunch, which, you know, we know exists.
Yeah, exactly. So we're gonna learn a lot more about free lunches. First, just a bit about, you probably all know about the Becker Brown Bag. It's part of the Becker-Friedman Institute, and I think that there are some sheets on the centers of your table that will tell you a little more about Becker-Friedman Institute if you would like to learn about some of the other activities that we do. We will take questions from the audience along the way, but I'm going to start the interview with Richard just by asking him a few questions. And let me tell you a little bit about him. So if you don't know much about Richard, he is a very unusual Chicago economist. And I just want to say, he looks at the world completely differently than most of the Chicago faculty. It's actually the first question I want to ask you. So when you started graduate school, what were you thinking? Why? I mean, knowing how you turned out, I cannot imagine what you was going through your mind when you started graduate school. Because you also got to maybe tell people what economics was like when you tell us what was economics like when you started, and why did you think you wanted to be an economist?
Well, you know, I think actually, like most economists, I ended up in economics because I wasn't good enough in math to do physics. Mm-hmm. Most economists failed at some other harder mathematics, and then you sort of end up finding your appropriate mathematical level. And then even within economics, so neither Steve and I are particularly good at math compared to many of our colleagues, so we have to be interesting instead of precise. But I certainly didn't start out thinking I was going to be a behavioral economist, since that didn't exist.
Right, exactly.
So when I was a little frustrated in graduate school, and but I set out to write a very standard thesis with a very standard thesis advisor, Sherwin Rosen, who was a graduate of Chicago, and I was at the University of Rochester, where he was as an assistant professor. And my thesis topic was on the value of a human life. And the approach.
Now, was that a radical or an original idea at that time, or no?
I was teaching a course in cost-benefit analysis, and this, you have to have a number. So you're going to make a highway safer, or remove some pollution, or do something, and you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, and it's going to save 20 lives, and what's that worth? And the approach at that time was very stupid, which was you added up the human capital of the people whose lives would be saved. And so what that would mean is, if you're going to save old people's lives, that has negative value. So as soon as you retire, we should, you know, knock those people off because we'll save all the Social Security payments they would get and Medicare and so forth. And saving babies also wouldn't be very valuable. I mean, their parents might disagree. So so I thought this was dumb. Tom Schelling had written a paper sketching out the right idea, which is that what we're interested in is what he called statistical lives. So some project like this will just change the probability that you'll die. So if we make Lakeshore Drive safer, a road I use every day to commute, so suppose that lowers my probability of death by 1 in 1,000 per year, then the question is, how much would I pay for that? So we had the Schelling provided the right conceptual framework, but nobody had a number. And so what I tried to do was find a way to estimate that number. And luckily, my father was an actuary. And so the idea I got was to estimate how much you have to pay people to get them to take risky jobs. And my father got me data on the mortality rates in risky jobs. And then I was able to match that up with other data and run a regression. And the coefficient on this turned into a number. The value of a life in $1967 was $300,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. That basic number is still used. It's now 3 million or something like that. But while I was working on that thesis, I thought it might be interesting to just ask people the conceptually right question. So I would ask people, suppose by coming to this lunch today, you've been exposed to a 1 in 1,000 risk of dying. Some rare disease. And this bottle of water is a cure. And we're going to sell it to the highest bidder. How much would you pay? And then I asked them another question, which was, the hospital's doing some research on this disease. All you'd have to do is expose yourself to a 1 in 1,000 risk of getting this disease. There won't be any cure. How much would you have to be paid to participate? Now, all of you know that theoretically those answers have to be approximately the same. But they were wildly different, like orders of magnitude different. So a typical answer would be, I'd pay $5,000 and I wouldn't do it for $1 million. So I said, yeah.
Were you the first person to ask the question like that?
Or yeah.
So you just happened to think to ask the question both ways?
Well, I mean, there was this framework, but nobody had bothered to ask whether the answers would be different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I found that they not only were they not the same, they were just completely different. So I brought these results over to Sherwin, and Sherwin was a lovable curmudgeon, and he told me to go back to work and do something serious, which is to run regression, do serious economics. And so this question does not appear anywhere in my thesis or in the paper that he and I wrote together. But it piqued my curiosity. And so that running that question is kind of what changed my life.
So you graduated.
Yeah.
That was completely out of your dissertation.
Yeah.
When did you come out of the closet as a behavioral economist?
So I then made my greatest intellectual discovery. I discovered two psychologists named Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Now,
and this was when? Early 70s?
This was 1975. And now, when I say I discovered them, they did exist. It's the same sense in which Columbus discovered America. It was here. But it counted as a discovery in economics because nobody had ever heard of it. And
how did you? You're an economist, and they're psychologists. How did you discover that?
Somebody, I met a guy at a conference who was a psychologist, and he told me about it. And then I went and read a bunch of their papers. And then I discovered that they were at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And I discovered that they were going to be visiting Stanford for a year. And I was supposed to go with Sherwin to Stanford for the summer to work on some more valuable life stuff. And I somehow managed to finagle a way of staying that year at Stanford. And so I spent that year teaching them economics and them teaching me psychology. And that's the year I came out of the closet.
And how did the economics profession react to your conversion?
Well, hostile would be too mild. Well, no, actually, hostile was for the minority of people who would even read it. So mostly it was just, you know, nobody would even read it.
Right, because you were not high profile. You were young.
I was
a young economist at Cornell, or where were you?
Well, I was still at Rochester. I was a PhD student in the economics department, then I got a job in the business school. And after this year at Stanford, I decided I had to get out of Rochester, which was considered at that time to be a Chicago farm club. And so they were really hostile to this idea. And so I moved to Cornell, moved south for the weather. And I wrote up one paper. It was rejected 8 times. And but I kept trying. And eventually there was a new journal that came out. And they were desperate for papers. So they took my paper.
What journal was that?
Journal of Economic Behavior and GBO. It was the first issue.
That was your first behavioral paper you published?
Yeah, 1980. And but basically for the next 10 years, every paper was a fun. And hostile referee reports, and hostile editors, but
how did you get a job here?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, well, I didn't get a job here until 1995, so 15 years later. Now, by that point, I had started to dabble in finance. So in 1985, I published a paper. My first PhD student at Cornell was a guy called Werner de Bont, a Belgian guy. And he wanted to do finance. And I didn't know anything about finance. But he actually knew quite a bit about finance. And he wanted to do finance. And he wanted to work with me. And I said, well, I don't know any finance. But, you know, I hadn't known anything about psychology either. That didn't stop me. So why should I let this stop me? So we started working together, and there was a well-known anomaly even then in the early 80s that value stocks outperformed other stocks. It was the P.E. anomaly. Low P.E. stocks did well. So we knew this fact. And it was just considered an anomaly. And now we set out to see whether we could demonstrate something that would be really embarrassing to finance professors. And so we decided, well, PE, the denominator is a little suspect because accountants are involved with E, and who knows what they're up to. So we said, well, how can we get rid of the E? And so we did something really simple. We ranked all the stocks over the last, say, 5 years for their total return from best to worst. And then we formed a portfolio of, say, the 50 best performing and 50 worst performing over the past 5 years. And then we looked to see how they did over the next 5 years. Well, efficient market hypothesis says they'll do the same as any other stock. And so that's the null hypothesis. Well, what we found was these losers outperformed the market by quite a bit, and the winners underperformed the market. And we wrote this paper up, and it was accepted in the Journal of Finance through a back door. And I've learned about all the back doors. I'm convinced without this back door, we never would have got this paper published because everyone knew it was wrong. So the back door was, at that time, if a paper was presented at the American Finance Association meeting, the president of the AFA picked like 12 papers to publish. And Fisher Black happened to be the president of the AFA that year, and he picked our paper. He thought it was interesting. So there it was in the Journal of Finance, and not with like 5 years of fight. If we had gotten it published, it wouldn't have been before 1990. This was published 3 months after we presented it. And there was a major disruption in the force in Rosenwald Hall. Armies of graduate students in finance were told to go find our program there. And so Merton Miller had one group, and Gene, our golfing buddy, had another group. And so...
That's Gene Fama.
Gene Fama. And so...
You're nowhere near Chicago yet. This is all...
I'm giving a long answer to this question. But this is... I'm filibustering because I'm worried you might have hard questions. So this actually, DeBont did all the programming, and he's really careful. So there was no programming error. And so Fama and French, Ken French was a young collaborator of Fama's at this time, and they replicated our results and then set out to figure out how to rationalize them. And that eventually led to the three-factor model. So, I mean, you can blame me for the three-factor model. And anyway, so I found that there was a great market for annoying finance professors. And so I wrote more finance papers. And then eventually, I got a job offer here. Fama says that they hired me because they wanted to keep an eye on me. Merton Miller, when he was asked why he hadn't blocked my appointment. He said in the press, well, every generation has to make its own mistakes. So I had a sign on my door for a while, this generation's mistake.
Yeah. So one thing I admire about you is that you are not afraid to take your academic findings in the real world. And so when it came to finance, you started a fund, right? And tell us a little bit about Fuller and Thaler.
Right after DeMont and I published this paper, there was a money management firm out in California that decided they wanted to do behavioral finance. They were ahead of their time. They hired me as a consultant. And then they wanted to hire a full-time research director. I helped them do a search and found this guy, Fuller, who had been the chairman of the finance department at Washington State. A real practical kind of guy. And they hired him, and then that firm went under. Fuller and I claim it's because they didn't pay enough attention to us. But then Fuller started a firm, and he asked me to help him. But he said, I don't have any money. I don't have any clients. So I can't pay you. But he said, if you help me, which meant every once in a while talking to a prospective client or something like that. He says, I'll send you a good case of wine. And then he said, if I ever make any money, I'll send you some money. And I said, okay, that sounds good. So that was our deal for 7 years. And then I spent another year at Stanford in 1998. And... which is where he is.
Wait, and before then, did you only get wine, or did you get wine?
I only got wine.
Okay.
I only got wine. I think around this time, he was about to send me a check, like, for $5,000. And so at that point, he had a really good track record, but not much money under management. And we decided there might be a way to leverage it up if I joined. And so we changed the name of the firm. And so we're still in business, which is good. And we what we try to do is take the sort of mistakes people make and use them to figure out ways to buy stocks. And my job there, I tried to get everybody in the firm to agree to have no titles, which everybody hates. So half the people in the firm are vice president. We have 18 people, 9 vice presidents. So I wanted the title guru.
Guru?
Guru.
Did you get it?
They won't let me. They won't let me put it on business cards. But that's what they all... Oh, the guru's in town today.
Yeah.
And you want the job of guru. So here's the most useful thing I'm going to tell you. You want to be the guru. You don't want to be the go-to. So...
So my favorite idea that you've ever had is mental accounts.
Yeah.
Because you invented mental accounts, right?
Yeah.
So can you explain what mental accounts are and why they are so important and how the people in this room can, how their lives can be changed through that understanding?
Well, you know, the basic idea in economics is that money is fungible. And actually, one of the tricks I figured out early on was the easiest way of to write a paper, to write a behavioral economics paper. As Danny Kahneman likes to say, economists give themselves the benefit of the null hypothesis. So you have to get a paper published, you have to show not only that you're right, but that there's no rational theory that could also explain these facts. And so the easiest way to do that was to take something that economists say shouldn't matter and show that it does. And you can think about my willingness to pay, willingness to accept original question as an example of that. So economists say those two things should be the same. They're very different. So money being fungible is a good example of that. So here's an example of mental accounting. You see somebody go to the casino and they win money. So they're now up $500. They'll take that $500, they'll put it in one pocket. They'll take, say they brought $500 with them to gamble, they put that in another pocket. I call this the two-pocket theory of gambling. And they treat the money they've won as different from, there's a name for that actually, it's called the house money, which because the casino is called the house. And so the house money is one kind of money, and then my money is, that's different. So we do that all the time. And once I had this notion, I started to see mental accounting all the time. And so one of the things I was first interested in was, why do people pay attention to sunk costs? So, you know, a friend of mine and I were given, this is when I was living in Rochester, given tickets to a basketball game in Buffalo. And it was a big blizzard. And so we had to decide whether to go to this game. Now, somebody had given us the tickets, so we decided not to go. But my buddy said, who was not an economist, he said, well, if we had paid for those tickets, we would be gone. And I said, well, you know, this is sunk cost. And so why do people pay attention to sunk costs? The answer to that, which I won't go into, but that's like mental accounting. So one of the areas where I've done a lot of work, and the area probably where the impact of behavioral economics has been the biggest, is in savings. So 401k plans have been radically changed in the last 10 years, mostly because of the work of behavioral economics. And one of the insights is, if you just get people to put money into a 401k plan, that money tends to be very sticky. Sometimes people will borrow from those funds, but they tend to pay them back. And so the first step of getting people to save is get it into an account they've labeled retirement. Well, that's mental accounting. And they just don't want to take that money out because that's retirement money. Now, they could have money in some other account that they were saving for retirement. But if it's labeled retirement money or the children's education money, right? So, you know, if you have a lot of kids, you're probably saving up for their, well, we get, yeah. Never mind, but U of C professors get a good deal on tuition. But anyway, a hypothetical parent would feel like it's almost a sin to spend from the children's education fund. That money is different. And mental accounting is a very rich idea. It's one of the first first ideas I had, and it's still interesting.
So it must have been 6 or 7 years ago, and I remember vividly in the cafeteria upstairs, Richard asked me if I would come and talk to him about something, and he had his friend Cass Sunstein was there, and he says to me, you know, I'm going to think of writing a popular book. I said, oh, great. I had just written Freakonomics. I said, what's the subject? And he said, libertarian paternalism. And I said, I'm not sure that that's really going to be so popular. And you said, oh, no, it's going to be really popular. And you asked for my advice about publishers and whatnot. And it turned into the book Nudge, which when you sent me the book, and I was just cringing when I opened it. I was so afraid of what I was going to find inside. And it was fantastic. And it was beautifully written. And it had great stories. And it ended up having, I think, just a remarkable impact for a popular book. I mean, it's and I can't think of a popular book in economics that has actually influenced behavior more. So I can think of two examples. So if I compare the... So first, tell us your favorite story. Do you have a favorite story in that?
Well, maybe the fly and the euro.
That was my favorite story, too.
Yeah. So some genius... Actually, there's allegedly an economist involved in this. So there was an economist who worked for Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. But anyway, there was a guy, he was in charge of like the operations, but there was some guy in the maintenance department who got the idea of etching the image of a housefly in the urinals in the men's rooms. And right near the drain, kind of where you should aim. And the claim, although no one's ever been able to find the data on this, the claim is that spillage, which is a great euphemism, spillage has been reduced by 80%. So that fly, to me, has come to be my image of what a nudge is. So a nudge is something in the environment that attracts our attention and influences our behavior. In the book, we coined the term humans and econs. So econs are the imaginary creatures that you study in all your economics classes who can calculate anything and never make mistakes and never overeat and never have hangovers, and you know. And whereas humans are us. So nudges work on humans, but they wouldn't work on econs. And now, I will say, you know, one of the most important things to realize is how big a role luck plays in life. So, Steve's book, the title was suggested by his sister. We didn't have a title for our book. We had an idea.
Libertarian paternalism and the ensuing dynamics of human behavior.
Yeah, no, but we had an even better one. Libertarian paternalism is not an oxymoron. I think that was just the books were going to just, you know.
Straight to the remainder's bit.
Yeah, right. Oh, they wouldn't print enough to get to the remainder's bit. So when we were peddling this book, some unnamed editor, some junior editor at Oxford University Press, which declined to publish the book, suggested, you know what would be a good title for this book? Nudge. And so the only credit I will take is realizing that's a really good idea. And then we wrote the book in such a way as our publisher couldn't stupidly change the title. Because publishers are idiots. And if you let them make any decisions, they will do it wrong. The other thing we did, I think, that was good was we insisted that Nudge was the title all around the world. You know, I think you guys did that too. But so even like if you look at the Korean edition, and we've sold 350,000 copies in Korea. We're big in Korea. the title is Nudge. And then there's a bunch of Korean stuff there. But this was I wanted to create a global word. Mm-hmm. And we've done that. Mm-hmm.
So it kind of turned you into a celebrity. How did you like... Do you do a lot of TV, and do you like the celebrity?
It's funny, Nate Silver was in town this weekend. I had coffee with him, and he's a celebrity. He was telling me he now gets recognized on the street. I don't get recognized. Do you get recognized?
No, I don't.
Right. So, you and I are like celebrities in small circles. And I wouldn't want to have, and I know Nate is not happy about it. I think this will die off in a few months and people will leave him alone. But I'm not that sort of celebrity. But I think the more interesting thing it's done is it's given me some sort of justification for being a guru on a broader scale. So most interesting development is David Cameron read the book, the PM of in the UK. Actually, one of his, he has a brilliant young advisor who you probably have met, Rohan right. Silva. Rohan read the book and gave it to Cameron. And Cameron made it part of their campaign. And I didn't know whether that would ever lead to anything. But they won. And they surprisingly created what everybody in the media calls the Nudge Unit. The official name is the Behavioral Insight Team. Well, there's John over there. Yeah, my Rohan's sister has a brother here. I won't embarrass him by name, but he has an Aussie accent, so you can find it. So I've now gone over several times, and I've done a few teaching stints in London. So I'll teach for a half a day and then go nudge for half a day. Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting. So we go, a typical day is I'll go with one of the guys in the Nudge Unit. And we'll go to some minister and a couple of the minister's senior staff, and they'll describe some problem to us and say, can you help us? It's like we're the shrinks. Mm-hmm. The biggest success we've had so far is one of the first guys we talked to was a guy in Treasury whose job it was to collect money from people who owed. And in England, If you're paid on a salary, they basically just take their share, and there's really no tax return to file. But if you have the equivalent of Schedule C income, then you have to file a return, and if you don't, they send you a letter. And so they wanted to know whether they could up the yield from these letters. And so we got them to run experiments. So we made some suggestions based on the work of Robert Cialdini, great psychologist who wrote a book called Influence. So we changed the letters and then started out sending lots of different forms of the letter. Well, the best letter has about a 10% higher yield than the letter they were using. And so just the experiments we've been running have raised several million pounds. And, right, these are just the trials. So running these trials has a negative cost of a few million pounds. And when we eventually roll it out nationwide, it'll be a big deal. So that's been the most fun part.
Okay. So I'm going to ask one more question, and people in the audience should be prepared to jump in after that. So what would you say to the business school students, from looking back at your life, what advice would you give folks in this room that you think would be worthwhile, in addition to the guru versus go-to advice you've already given?
Yeah, that's the best one. Well, the advice I have is, when I started doing this work with Fuller and Thaler, I told them I have a rule, which is I don't do anything if it's not fun. And that if if being involved in this firm stopped being fun, I was going to quit. And so that's my other advice.
I think that's good advice. I think that I was just talking to an MBA graduate. Maybe he'd been out for 7 or 8 years, and he was thinking of changing careers, and he was describing what all his attributes or what he was good at. And I said, "Well, what do you enjoy?" And he's just puzzled, and what, by the end of the conversation, what had become clear is he had forgotten that work could possibly be fun. He had thought that the only work was about making money, was about rising up. And I think by the end, he had actually had switched his view of trying to think about what he'd do next based on actually reimagining that the world could be fun. I think that's fantastic.
I mean, that's one of the things you and I have in common, is that our research topics are things we think are interesting, mm-hmm. and would be fun to find the answers to,
right.
rather than can we figure out some way of estimating this thing to 5 decimal places.
Because some other people have done it before, and you want to get credit for doing it better. Yeah.
Professor Thaler, you've been doing a column for the Wall Street Journal.
Actually, it's that other paper.
In New York Times.
Yeah.
And you seem to be recommending a lot of policy recently. You recommended policy around taxes. I want to personally thank you for the policy you recommended around the whole gay marriage issue. Is anyone listening? Is that column having any effect that you've seen?
Well, who knows? I had a column in January where I suggested that the Senate adopt a rule that all nominations be, that the default option be the nominations are approved after 90 days unless the Senate turns them down. And I shared that with David Axelrod, who put it in the State of the Union speech. Now, Harry Reid apparently didn't read the column, but I've seen some quotes that Harry's changing his mind. And so I think filibuster reform, we might see filibuster reform. So I don't know, people, you know, you write those columns and then I have a column coming out on Sunday that everybody here should like, because it's in praise of geeks. So I'll let you read it, but needless to say, everyone here qualifies.
Professor Thaler, since you changed the way people are thinking about the world, do you somehow apply the research findings in your own personal life? Do you think now differently about life?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, one of the things I've written about a lot is self-control problems. And so, again, so this is an example of where economic theory basically assumes that self-control problems don't exist. It's not that there's nowhere you can find that in an economics principles book, that there's no self-control problems. Instead, what you read is people do what's in their best interest. Now, anybody who's ever woken up with a hangover will realize maybe, I mean, it's not proof. It could be that you had enough fun the night before that you knew you were going to have the hangover. But on the other hand, it's possible that you think that the seventh margarita was a mistake. I like many academics, have various ways of getting myself to work. The guy I've written the most papers with is the guy who's best at bugging me. And, you know, in Nudge we have a footnote about the difference between nudge and nudge. And he's a nudge. He typically, the way we work is he'll run some experiments or some regressions and send them to me and send some tables and say, you know, when can you write this up? And I say, I can't even look at this. I can't even look at this until the middle of January. He says, okay. January 15th, I get a call. All right, January 15th, you know. But, you know, many of us will do things like agree to give a paper at some conference 9 months from now, a paper that we would like to write but are worried about procrastinating about. And then we know 3 weeks before the conference we're going to be really regretting that decision to commit ourselves. But after a few sleepless nights, there will be at least a first draft of that paper. And so, yeah, I mean, I more or less practice what I preach. Was that a nudge, Paul?
So I'm an evening weekend student, and I work also at a company that's trying to inspire behavioral change or energy efficiency in small businesses. So we've read Nudge, we've read Influence, and we've read Predictably Irrational, but all of these seem to be influenced.
2 out of 3 is good.
they seem to be mostly directed towards influencing individuals to act, And we're wondering if we're making a mistake to try to move towards influencing businesses, small businesses, like an agency problem or something. I read some of your blogs just before coming to this and saw some recommendations for economic incentives, but they were just regular, you know, like for the oil industry. Are we fighting a battle we can't win?
No. I mean, I don't think there's any difference between organizations and, I mean, organizations have people.
Sure. But there are agents. Our issue is that there are different agents that make decisions and act.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I'm very well aware of that. And, yeah, you have to find who the decision makers are. And as Steve and I have talked about this, there are a lot of situations where a firm will do something that doesn't seem to be profit maximizing. And people will say, oh, well, that's a principal agent problem or an agency problem. And my line is, in many of these cases, it's not an agency problem. It's what I call a dumb principal problem. And I've seen this firsthand. I think my favorite paper is my football paper. So I wrote a paper with a former Booth PhD student named Cade Matthews, now at Wharton, and about the NFL draft. You can find it online. And what we find is that teams overvalue picking early. And we've been involved with two teams trying to help them. And in both cases, we were able to convince everyone except the owner. And in both cases, the owners were strong-willed and rejected our advice. Actually, at the team I've been working with most recently, we got them to hire a Booth student who was Steve's RA. And so that's been frustrating. And I think we're about to all move to a new organization with a smarter owner. And the lesson I've taken from that is that if you don't get buy-in from the top, it's just not going to work. And I've seen there's so much frustration in both places where the teams are just making dumb mistakes, but either coaches or general managers, either they're dumb themselves, or if they're smart, they're worried about being fired for making a smart decision that the owner thinks is dumb. So I think you guys can make progress, but it has to be with an organization where you have buy-in at the top. Yeah, this side of the room is dead. There's a microphone over there.
Back to the set.
All right. So this is a bias.
This will be our last question.
I walk from the other side of the room. So, Professor Taylor, you mentioned that your book's reception in Korea has been really, really amazing. 350,000 copies sold. And the examples you've given in your talk today have been mostly, you know, policy in the U.S. or study or experiments in the U.S. and in the U.K. Would you have any examples aligned with human behavior being a general or universal concept where... What you've learned in your career is applicable in international and specifically in developing or emerging countries?
So, absolutely. Another one of my former Booth students a guy called Dean Carlin, is an MBA here. He's now an economics professor at Yale. And what he does, I'm actually doing a fundraiser for him tomorrow night. He has an organization called IPA that, so he runs field experiments in poor countries using behavioral economics. So one of his experiments was how to get people to save. Another was how to get people to quit smoking. And then, because Dean has more energy than any five people I know, he also has created an organization that then takes these ideas to scale. And that's something that, as academics, we get no credit for. So, for example, probably the idea that I've had that has had the biggest impact on the world is something called Save More Tomorrow, which is an idea where you get people in a 401k plan to agree to commit themselves to increasing their contributions every year until they reach some goal. Now, we got, after many years of trying, we finally got a company to try this. And that gave us the data to write a paper, and we got a publication. And then, as a professor, at that point, you declare victory, and there's no return to doing anything else. But if you care about the world, you want to do something more than that. Well, there are now 9 million people saving more tomorrow. And so it's not like I made that happen. Ben Artsy, my co-author, the one who nudges, has been helpful. But firms have figured out that this works. But what Dean is willing to do is raise the money to take one of his experiments and then make it happen. So he's been doing this like with deworming kids in Africa. And Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee do similar work. And so if you're interested in that area, both of those have books out in the last couple of years. And I would recommend both of those books if you're interested in that.
Great. Well, can't thank you enough for sharing your wisdom with us.
My pleasure.
Very much enjoyed it.
Thank you.